that I would want to say. And then secondly, I want to quote something that he says toward the end of this essay, where he says, "For the good of the country, we need to explode the national myth or dominant ideology that America has always been freedom and equality, while racism is just some departure from the norm." And in fact, the outline that he gives of this period roughly between 1770 and the point of where the freedom struggle is taking place, he says that a significant part of the problem is the nation's burial of history and absence from schools. And I have to note that this is 2010. It's still an issue today if we think about the Texas State Board of Education and its recent decision on revising the history that would be made available in the schools of that state. He takes the periods and he basically divides them in this way. From 1770 to 1860, a period of early capital accumulation and land confiscation and movement westward. The period of 1865 to 1915, where he notes that industry triumphs over agriculture, notes the Civil War and Reconstruction period. The two World War periods, 1914 through 1945, and then he basically divides the final part up from 1945 to the time of the Civil Rights Movement. I just want to spend a little time on the beginning, where he talks about the difference in capitalist development in Europe versus the capitalist development in the United States. In Western Europe, he notes that basically there was a movement of the system of feudalism, you know, moving over into a system of capitalism. In the United States, there was no feudal history to speak of, and that basically two forms of capitalism developed. He used the term of relatively free democratic path, and the second one, the totalitarian path, which is defined by the slave trade and slavery. In the United States, he talks about the two forms of development in those early years, that you did have family farms. Basically, the labor was of the all of the family members of that farm, and basically created a subsistence economy. In some cases, some of those farms accumulated enough resources where they may hire, you know, one or more additional workers, but that's sort of the one angle of this. The other angle of this is the plantation-developed farm, which was slave-based and required that kind of farming was for cash crops and required the clearing of land, required a lot of labor to clear that land. And this farming for cash crops obviously made the plantation owners wealthy, but in terms of the rest of the capitalist class, much of which based in the North, created the basis for wealth in terms of shipping, textile, banks, and so forth, that actually developed credit systems to keep this going and expand it. He notes the competition, if you will, between the slave trade triangle of England, Africa, West Indies, versus Boston, Africa, and South Carolina, as an example. He even talked about some states were stronger in plantation development than others. So he noted that Kentucky and Virginia sort of, while they were not as strong in the plantation development as the bottom southern states, these states got to become profit makers in the breeding of slaves as if they were animals. All of this time, there has been a history of abolitionists and opposition to slavery in all of this time. And basically, he notes that the development of the cotton gin reduced the impact of moral arguments against slavery and swept aside justified by economic and laws that actually perpetuated this, what he calls the totalitarian path of capitalist development. Not to spend too much time on that, but he notes that 1820 to 1865 was the height of slave trade, yet alongside of this slave economy, this American democracy, if you will, was growing alongside it. And he used the term growing alongside of congenital deformity of slavery and genocide, which I just think is quite a powerful, accurate description. I could throw my editorial in. But anyway, he goes on to give examples about how laws and the support of the federal government actually accelerated and perpetuated the further domination over the physical movement of slaves, the ability to read these dramatic cases of, you know, cutting off people's hands if they were found trying to read a book. He talks about 50 million acres of tribal lands taken to spread the cotton plantation system, which was the most profitable export. He goes on to talk about that this did not occur without major resistance, and he gave examples of Native American resistance, African American resistance, as well as a discussion of the basic thievery of the northern half of Mexico, which results now in the six states of Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Nevada, and California. What he notes toward the end of the of this presentation, and he goes into Reconstruction, and he goes into the betrayal, basically, after the Civil War, and the betrayal of African Americans at the time. He notes the book by W.B. Du Bois, Black Reconstruction, and he goes on to say that to talk about the myth of what actually occurred during Reconstruction. He noted that even though this was a period where hello,
I'm sorry, I'm driving.
Oh, hello, is this Anne?
Yeah.
Okay. He notes that this is a period where, you know, blacks in some significant numbers were elected to state offices, but he also notes that at no state had a majority of black state legislature, and that there were actual federal government activities that took place to basically put the squash on any kind of democracy to be experienced for blacks in length of time. And the main point that he makes toward this is the removal of federal troops in the post-Civil War period.
Excuse me, Mildred, can we have people mute their phones?
I'm going to get off. That might be me because I'm at the toll booth and probably picking up that.
Hey, just mute your phone.
Well, I don't know how to do that on the jawbone.
Star six.
I mean, pound six. Sorry, pound six.
Okay, that seems to work.
Okay. During this Reconstruction period, with the federal troops officially removed from the many southern states during this period, made it possible for what was already developing to come out full force, and that was the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, which he notes that predated Hitler Germany by 50 years, but that the Ku Klux Klan set up a system of terrorist rule in the South, set up a system of basically the removal of the blacks to participate in the electoral system, and that further law enforcement occurred in that courts actually organized the way in which they enforced law by a racial code. He goes on to say that that this period had official rejection of the truth. He even went on to talk about, quote, Christian churches and their inability to practice Christianity because of obeying these racial codes. So he goes on to talk about this period and the actual betrayal of blacks, and he says, he carefully says betrayal of blacks and the Constitution, in that this racial code codification and racial overlay of how law was going to be enforced is what became the norm, or became the norm of the day, even though militarily the Civil War had been won, but politically this totalitarian racist practice in many ways remained intact. So anyway, to try and wrap this up and move it to the 20th century, he goes on to note that this, the culmination of these activities, these events in history, had to be sustained also because, just like we talked about the economic development and capitalist development of the earlier period in American history, in this period, in the post-Civil War era, you had this triumph of the industrial approach and wage labor over slave labor, but it was still in the interest, obviously, of the capitalist class to keep those wages as low as possible. And if a serious ideological divide could occur, that would prevent what might have been a natural coalition between poor working whites, former slaves, and additional poor immigrants coming into the country, as well as Native Americans and persons who were here in the original boundaries of Mexico. If there were not for this ideological push along racist lines, it may have been feared that women would have come together in order to improve their lives collectively. So, he goes on to describe that in order to effectively ignore what black citizens were saying to be important, America had to, quote, ignore the black man and his very presence on the scene as a man entitled to human rights as respect. He goes on to call this an American habit for the chief mental block frustrating a dialogue in American race relations. It's as if you have to pretend as if the democratic development of the United States occurred and flourished in its highest possible form, when in fact the democratic development of the United States was in fact retarded by this totalitarian approach and dominate as it was dominated by the slave trade, the treatment of slaves and the and everything associated with that. He goes on to talk about something called the Teutonic Origins Theory, which is basically a somewhat of a scholarly approach, if you will, of confirming or giving approval of white supremacist ideas. I'd like to just call your attention to a book that is current and new right now. It's called The History of White People, and the author is Nell Painter. She also wrote a book on Jose Hudson, and she's a Princeton-based black historian woman. And if there's any interest in further delving into this sort of scholarly pursuit of the white supremacist ideology, she spends a lot of time on that, and it's a very interesting compliment, I would say, to the passages in this chapter where Jack O'Dell goes into this whole issue of promoting things all Anglo-Saxon, that anything worthy in terms of the development of civilization has in its origin, can be traced back to its historical roots in, as he says, tribal institutions of ancient Germany, as if other historical civilizations didn't exist or didn't count prior to what occurred in ancient Germany. I'd just like to call people's attention to that particular book. He goes on to quote a passage in a book that Carl Sandburg wrote about Abraham Lincoln, where he says, "Slaveholders are threatening to snuff out the moral life around us." And he takes that quote to go on and say that the former slaveholders did overthrow Reconstruction democracy and did establish a state system of segregation. Most noted by the landmark legislation of the ruling of Plessy v. Ferguson. So he goes on to say that post-Reconstruction and on into the 20th century, the moral life stayed out of the South, and that with this, quote, gentleman's agreement that racial totalitarianism regime acceptance basically took place nationwide. He goes on to talk about how this post-Reconstruction period solidified the two-party political system, where the clarity would be that there would be racists in both parties. He talks about a series of weak Republican presidents between 1876 and 1900, and that the federal government officially worked during this period, and then therefore beyond, of the non-enforcement of constitutional rights. So, if you will, what I think he is saying when it's all said and done is if you understand all of these elements prior to 1964 at the time he was writing, is that you had institutionalized the deliberate non-enforcement of constitutional rights for all people residing in the United States, and that the notion of who is deserving and undeserving, who should be considered a citizen or not a citizen, who should be considered worthy of fulfilling their human potential, is all based in this immoral and economically driven system of capitalism. And in this country, its acceleration and success, if you will, can be found in the way in which millions of people were subjugated to these barbaric conditions to make sure that a few people basically succeeded economically. And to keep that going, and to keep support for that going, it was a very strong requirement, I would say, to keep the ideology going that people who were not soon to be millionaires at that time, it was in their interest to look at their own neighbor, co-worker, and person of color next to them as the enemy, and not those people who were actually about the business of accumulating, keeping, and perpetuating a hoarding of capital. I'll stop there.
Okay, thank you, Mildred. Are there any questions to Mildred? Okay, let's go on. Zach?
Can we make comments?
Oh, no, we're going to have a discussion at the end.
Okay.
Zach?
Okay. My assignment was to make some comments on Jack O'Dell's essay, Climbing Jacob's Ladder, The Life and Times of the Freedom Movement, which was published in Freedom Ways in the winter of 1969. First, I'm going to talk about the context of the essay. The essay was published between the time of the summer 1967 rebellions by the African-American urban poor in the ghettos of over 30 U.S. cities, and the time of the momentous hospital workers' strike in Charleston, South Carolina in summer 1969. It was published just months after the assassination of Martin Luther King in April 1968, as he came to the support of striking sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee. O'Dell wrote this essay, The Life and Times of the Freedom Movement, in a period of crisis in the movement. Addressing this crisis in 1968, Dr. King wrote, quote, "The paths of Negro-white unity that had been converging crossed at Selma and, like a giant X, began to diverge. Up to Selma, there had been unity to eliminate barbaric conduct. Beyond it, the unity had to be based on the fulfillment of equality, and in the absence of agreement, the paths began inexorably to move apart," end quote. The elements of this crisis were a long declining level of organization of the U.S. working class and its lack of orientation to social struggle, a crisis in black-white unity, class divisions within the African-American community, an alarming rise in police state methods of repression not limited to the South but at the national level, and ideological divisions over the meaning of power and how to attain it for African-Americans. At the same time, with the walls of McCarthyism and segregation broken down by the earlier action of the civil rights movement, there emerged a general protest, mass protest movement whose driving force was among the youth, black, white, and Latino. Toward the end of the 1960s, radicals, both black and white, in certain quarters, began to question the validity of the civil rights movement itself. O'Dell's essay was both a polemic against that view as well as an assertion that the next logical steps for the movement could clearly be seen in King's call for a poor people's campaign. To make these points, O'Dell puts forward in this essay the idea of the civil rights movement as part of a long historic chain of events, a view of things that now, decades later, has become accepted by academic historians under the key concept of the long civil rights movement. O'Dell defines the civil rights movement as what he called a particular phase in the developmental history of our modern freedom movement. It came to be called the civil rights movement because the emphasis of our struggle in this period was upon achieving the restoration of those civil rights for black Americans which had been nullified by the counter-revolutionary overthrow of Reconstruction in the years 1876 to 1900. End quote. On the background of his scientific view of history, O'Dell points to the importance of understanding that there is such a thing as revolutionary patience. And he illustrates the concept of revolutionary patience with the example of Dr. King writing, quote, "With boundless faith that what he regarded as the moral law of the universe assured the ultimate victory of our freedom movement, the Reverend Martin Luther King stayed on the battlefield, sustained by the spiritual traditions of the Negro Church. In this faith, he shared the confident determination of those of our ancestors who created the Negro spiritual when they sang, 'Didn't my Lord deliver Daniel? Deliver Daniel, deliver Daniel. Didn't my Lord deliver Daniel? And why not every man?'" Next, I want to turn to O'Dell's summary of the history of the civil rights movement, which he encapsulates in just a very short space, but it's an important summary. O'Dell locates the beginning of the contemporary civil rights movement in the 1955 Montgomery bus boycott. He emphasizes that the demands initially were very minimal and focused not on eliminating the entire edifice of segregation, but on a sort of equal enforcement of the rules of seating and matters of basic human dignity on the buses. The key element, O'Dell points out, was a shift in tactics. The Montgomery movement learned from the unsuccessful 1953 bus campaign in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, that focused its tactics on the courtroom. The Montgomery movement joined the struggle in the courtroom while sustaining the mass organizing of a boycott. The movement and its tactics spread. O'Dell points out, quote, One must take note of the fact that most of the leaders of these bus boycotts in the South had long been associated with the NAACP, but were stepping outside the NAACP organizational structure in turning to mass action, end quote. The tactic of joining mass direct action with struggle in the various institutions of the state reflected the labor-based movement of the Popular Front period of the 1930s and 40s, in which key Montgomery leaders such as Edgar Nixon had participated. In the 1957 prayer pilgrimage to Washington, the African American Church asserted its leading organizational role. This challenged the white Christian community to reappraise its relevance to current social matters. Dr. King's keynote address, Give Us the Ballot, stated a strategic objective that grew in importance for the movement in the following years. Then in 1959 came the Youth March for Integrated Schools, focusing on the slow pace of school desegregation. In the course of organizing this demonstration, over 400,000 signatures were collected on a petition to Congress demanding action on the 1954 Supreme Court decision against school segregation. In 1960, student sit-ins rocked college campuses across the South, and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was formed with the help of Martin Luther King and Ella Baker. As O'Dell says, quote, the youth ended the debate on the style of the civil rights movement. They chose to take to the streets, end quote. In the spring of 1961, the Freedom Rides extended the local victories against bus segregation to the field of interstate commerce. The end of 1961 saw the beginning of the Albany, Georgia movement. O'Dell writes, quote, this was one of the most important developments during this decade in the life of Black America's freedom movement. For at Albany, Georgia, the whole system of segregation in every aspect came under attack from the Black community. In a sense, Albany, Georgia marked the end of the period that began with Montgomery and the beginning of the period that was to give us Birmingham, Savannah, and Danville, Virginia. The movement had become uncompromising in its demands that segregation be ended, not just segregation on the local buses or segregation at the lunch counters, but all segregation. And for the first time, mass action against segregation was supported by an organized voter registration drive. The Albany, Georgia movement brought together the issue of political power and an end to segregation, end quote. The events in Birmingham took place in 1963, the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. During this campaign against segregation by city government and downtown retailers, King wrote his famous letter from Birmingham jail, a response to 8 white Alabama clergymen who agreed that social injustices existed, but argued that the battle against racial segregation should be fought solely in the courts, not in the streets. King explained his basic tenets of nonviolence and wrote, quote, actually, we who engage in nonviolent direct action are not the creators of tension. We merely bring to the surface the hidden tension that is already alive. We bring it out in the open where it can be seen and dealt with, end quote. In writing about this, O'Dell argues about the significance of Birmingham. He says, the significance of Birmingham rests in the fact that it was that particular action which finally brought a response from the federal government in the form of new legislative proposals which, limited though they were more advanced than anything that had been proposed up to that time, end quote. Mass actions across the South, the March on Washington, the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church, which killed 4 little girls who were attending Sunday school, and the assassination of President Kennedy finally moved Congress to pass the 1964 Civil Rights Bill. The year 1965 brings us to the events at the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, where the theme, Give Us the Ballot, asserted at the 1957 prayer pilgrimage, echoed across the years. As O'Dell puts it, at Selma, what he says is peaceful marchers going to petition the legislature in Montgomery were suddenly faced with the atrocities of the police in the police state of Alabama. At the federal level, the Johnson administration responded by first securing a federal court injunction against the marchers. Secondly, another civil rights bill was introduced into Congress and later became the Voter Rights Act of 1965. Selma held a great symbolism for us, because with the Selma experience, the freedom movement began to cross the bridge from being a movement of primarily moral persuasion to becoming one with emphasis on demanding greater decision-making political power for the black community in American life, end quote. Odell continues, in what is undoubtedly one of the most significant coincidences in our modern history, the events at Selma also mark the beginning of the escalation of the American military role in Vietnam. This development, coincidental with Selma, was destined to have a far-reaching impact on the ideology of the freedom movement, end quote. Odell analyzed the developmental pattern of the evolving movement, its tactics, and strategic objectives. He writes, summarizing this history that he's just put forward in brief form, he writes, it reveals how a movement emerging from a previous period often begins with a modest minimum program of demands. As it increasingly comes to understand its strength and potential, it sets its sights on a larger spectrum of demands, embracing a larger area of the freedom aspiration. In the course of persistently pursuing these on the battlefield, it draws into its ranks and touches the lives of more and more people indirectly. Its perception of truth becomes keener and its ideology deepens. Finally, there is that qualitative change, transforming the character of a movement into a fundamentally different quality than the movement it was when it began, end quote. Odell ends his essay with a brief reflection on the next phase as he saw it. He ends his essay arguing for Martin Luther King's strategic concept of a poor people's campaign. He writes, quote, in the civil rights era or phase, we won the ballot. In the struggle for recognition of human dignity of the poor, a class embracing all ethnic, nationality, and racial groups, we will win representative government. In this perspective, the Poor People's Campaign is the opening act in a qualitatively new period in the freedom movement. This massive confrontation with the poverty condition and the institutional arrangement, here he's talking about capitalism, which created and perpetuates it, mirrors the dynamics involved in the evolution of a revolutionary freedom movement, end quote. The Charleston hospital workers' strike began just a few months after the publication of this essay in March 1969, and I guess it went for more than 3 months. In that strike, Odell saw the maturing of King's idea of a poor people's campaign. And I'm going to end there.
Okay. Any questions for Zach? Okay, you're on.
This is Nyla Rosen with the Odell Center, the Jack Hunter Odell Education and Reflection Center in Kent, Washington. And I have a question for Mr. Robinson or for Ms. Williamson, perhaps. And I would also like to thank you, Mr. Blythe, and others at CCDS for organizing this wonderful discussion. Jack Odell has emphasized to us at the Institute for Community Leadership the importance of teaching economic history in our schools and communities, and that seems to be something that's come up in the two articles that you, Mr. Robinson, and Ms. Williamson have just outlined for us. Could you say a little bit more about that, how economic history and it has come up in those two articles?
Mildred, do you want to begin?
I think at least my read of the chapter that I had, there's several things. One of the things he opened the chapter with that I didn't talk about, he was speaking about what he called Goldwaterism at the time. And he said that that was no political accident. And when I think about that, again, it brings me to this issue of, as he described earlier, you had this development in the country primarily fueled by exploitation. You know, you have to, you know, with the 13 colonies and the slavery being a part of it from the very beginning, as well as this whole notion of what was to come in terms of production. Odell hints to it when he talks about feudalism to capitalism in Western Europe, and he talks about a different pathway to what we now know as capitalism in the United States, some of which across both areas and around the world is fueled by technological development. But that said, in order for this particular system to survive, capitalism being a system where a few benefit extraordinarily at the expense of many millions of others, if you take that sort of basic, perhaps simplistic description of a system, then it would set the tone for how social relations take place and get perpetuated over time in order to keep those people who have this significant power in their hands, keep them remaining with that power. And when it's a system that results in the great benefits to a very few of the population, all kinds of things need to take place to keep the many millions from I'm being simplistic and perhaps crude here, from pulling together to acquire a power, to arrest some of that power out of the hands of the few. So when he talks about a Goldwaterism and the statements that he made at the time, that the minorities are in too much control in the country and all this kind of thing, that perpetuates in people who are not enlightened about who the common allies really are, that what that does is to have a role in confusing people in terms of who allies really are and who they may not be. So if one were to take that up, that too many minorities are in too much power in the country at the time, it's 1964, and pull that together with the birthers of today, with the Tea Party people of today, with Obama and so forth, it's very much of the same ideology. And what that does, if people accept that ideology in the millions, that results in the kinds of many of the election results that we get, and it results in those people who have this amass of power in their hands, who may be a few numbers, making sure that they keep it.
All right.
I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
This is Zach. Could I just say a couple words about that?
Go ahead.
Just on the a word about how Jack uses the economic history in this particular essay. What this, you know, the essay was written at a very important turning point for the movement in the late 60s. And what Odell says is, you know, the movement up to that time cleared away the worst of the brutalities of segregation and began the reconquest of after the betrayal of Reconstruction, the reconquest of political power for African Americans. So the question then began to present itself, well, with these victories, where do we go? Where do we go from here? And he raises that in the context of talking about the poor people's movement and pointing directly to the systemic origins of the problems people were facing. And he saw, you know, after the movement cleared away all these, the segregation, the Jim Crow rules, that people could finally confront the systemic origin of the problems, which Odell lay very deeply inside the economic system. And that confrontation with the system would allow people to develop, you know, a lasting movement, lasting change, and clear-headed strategy and tactics, which is what he was arguing for when he strongly spoke about King's Poor People's Campaign. And on that note, I mean, you know, Martin Luther King himself raised those very issues, especially at the end of his life in his book, Where Do We Go From Here, that addressed that question. It's such a beautiful quote. I happen to have it in front of me. I'm going to read it. It's just a few sentences. King writes in this book, "I want to say to you as I move to my conclusion, as we talk about where do we go from here, that we honestly face the fact that the movement must address itself to the question of restructuring the whole of American society. There are 40 million poor people here, and one day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America? And when you ask that question, you are raising questions about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth. When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalistic economy. And I'm simply saying that more and more we've got to begin to ask questions about the whole society. We are called upon to help the discouraged beggars in life's marketplace, but one day we must come to see that an edifice that produces beggars needs restructuring. It means that questions must be raised. You see, my friends, when you deal with this, you begin to ask the question, who owns the oil? You begin to ask the question, who owns the iron ore? You begin to ask the question, why is it that people have to pay water bills in a world that is two-thirds water? These are questions that must be asked. And this is Martin Luther King's words, really, that address the same question you were raising about why the importance of teaching economic history.
Thank you.
Okay. Harry, you're on next. Harry, would you talk, would you be sure and give your email address, because you wrote your remarks out and maybe people...
Yeah. Okay. My name's Harry Targ, and my email address is targ@purdue.edu. Purdue is spelled purdue.edu. I was asked to comment on Jack O'Dell's essay called A Rock in a Weary Land, Paul Robeson's Leadership in the Movement in the Decade Before Montgomery. And this essay was published in 1971 in Freedom Ways. Jack O'Dell's essay celebrates the life and activism of Paul Robeson, but does so in a historical and materialist way. In this excellent essay, O'Dell grounds the emergence of Robeson as a phenomenal historical figure in the context of the emerging militant progressive majority of the 1930s and the demands for a New Deal. He emphasizes the role of the African-American working class in the struggle for workers' rights in the creation of the CIO in the 1930s. And O'Dell says, quote, "Our movement for equal rights and freedom has shifted sharply to the left during the Depression years," unquote. With war clouds spreading across Europe and Asia, progressives including Robeson joined the worldwide fight against fascism. After World War II, O'Dell tells us the forces of global capitalism sought to recreate their faltering profits and empires. European colonial powers sought to crush the anti-colonial movements struggling to be free. U.S. capitalists sought to penetrate the war-torn and devastated economies of Europe and Asia. In the United States, southern fractions of the capitalist class embarked on the project to recreate the world of slavery and segregation that the wartime propaganda promised to purge from the planet. For the South and the nation, forces of racism and reaction were committed to returning to post-Reconstruction days. Robeson and the left resist. Paul Robeson became the paradigmatic figure, the metaphor for the freedom struggles in the United States and around the world. He was a freedom fighter against racism, colonialism, anti-Semitism, imperialism, war, and worker exploitation. As O'Dell suggests, and I quote O'Dell here, Robeson emerged as the prototype of a folk hero. And Odell says his eloquence, his mastery of over 20 languages, Odell says, quote, gave us as a people a special link through him to an understanding with the peoples of Africa, Asia, and the growing socialist world community in that critical period in world history, unquote. Odell reminds us that Paul Robeson participated in the struggles against the Cold War, lynchings, segregation in housing, schools, education, and sports, anti-communism in the labor movement, the formation of NATO, the Korean War, and the arms race. Robeson worked on the campaign of Henry Wallace for president and supported progressive trade unions. He launched the newspaper Freedom, gave his full support to the Southern Negro Youth Congress, the National Negro Congress, the National Negro Labor Council, the Domestic Workers Union in Harlem, and the Council of African Affairs. Odell reminds us that this struggle between imperialism and resistance was heightening after 1945, at a time when socialism was spreading around the world. The anti-colonial movements in India, Indonesia, China, and West Africa were near victory, and African Americans returned from war, expecting a new dawn of freedom and equality. Odell continues then to describe the historical Robeson in the context of anti-communism, state repression, racism, and the stifling of civil liberties in the 1950s. Odell reminds us of the Peekskill riot of 1949, when the forces of racism and national chauvinism battered and beat up progressives, while instrumentalities of the state, the police, stood by and watched the violence. Later on, the passports of Paul Robeson, W.E.B. Du Bois, and others were pulled by the State Department, hoping to silence progressive voices in America, communicating with the outside world. Robeson and thousands of others were hounded by congressional committees and local right-wing groups and were stifled in their efforts to earn a living by corporate red squads. While not unique in American history, Marty Jeser was correct in titling his book on the 1950s, The Dark Ages. On Odell's contribution to our understanding of Paul Robeson, as with the entire collection, Odell grounds his analysis in the history and political and economic context of the time. Robeson, no doubt, was a man of extraordinary talent, determination, and personal heroism. I think Odell regards Robeson as deserving to be in the ranks of W.E.B. Du Bois, Dr. King, Ella Baker, and Malcolm X. But, as with all these figures, Robeson was a product of the patterns of repression and resistance in his day. His heroism, like the others mentioned, was the product of the times in which he lived, the massive resistance of the voiceless throngs who marched, shouted, prayed, gave hard-earned money, and occasionally picked up the gun to strive for freedom. And Robeson was a product of the outpouring of support he received over the years from black freedom fighters and churchgoers in the United States, masses in India, Indonesia, Ghana, and Kenya, Welsh miners, Canadian trade unionists, and the hundreds of thousands of workers who organized in steel, auto, electronics, mining, and meatpacking industries. The last and perhaps most important point raised by Jack Odell is that the struggle against racism, imperialism, and class exploitation in the United States continued in the 1940s and 50s between the sit-down strikes in Flint, Michigan in 1937 and the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955. Because of what Paul Robeson, W.E.B. Du Bois, and the millions who supported them did, they were purposefully eliminated from history and our consciousness. The civil rights and peace movements of the 50s and 60s and beyond were intimately connected to and inspired by the campaigns and struggles of the 1940s and 1950s. This is why we need to celebrate anew the life and times of Paul Robeson. Thank you.
Okay, any questions for Harry? Okay, Bill, you're on.
Okay, I wanted to preface my discussion with one thing, and that is that I had not been able to get a hold of the book. I just found out that it won't, you know, that they had trouble delivering it, and it will be delivered sometime next week. But I also have not had a lot of time to do reading because of the struggle that we have here in Mississippi. And I, for those of you who do not know me, I have been a union organizer basically since 1960. And since the 1966, organizing workers in the South, up to, from farm workers to healthcare workers and public workers and casino workers, up to the beginning of our organization, the Mississippi Immigrant Rights Alliance, and we have been organizing immigrant workers here in Mississippi. But I came here 21 years ago in 1989 to begin the organization of State Employees Union, which is, it has been a successful union here in Mississippi. And one of the things that had been going on here is the movement that did not end. And there were people that were in my generation that were active in the movement from the 50s and 60s, you know, Dick Dennis and Bob Moses and Hollis Watkins were all people that I worked with as we were building the State Employees Union, and then later with the casino worker, a very successful campaign. There are now about 8,000 casino workers organized here in Mississippi. That led, you know, because of the number of immigrant workers, led to the founding of the Mississippi Immigrant Rights Alliance. But all during this time, we have viewed the movement as continuing, and with the in-migration of migrant workers that have been displaced primarily by NAFTA and by other treaty agreements and violence in their countries of origin, the vast majority of people that are coming here from Mexico and Guatemala and Honduras are people of color, basically indigenous people from those countries, from a lot of different ethnic groups, in Mayan ethnic groups and other indigenous groups from Oaxaca and Chiapas and other places. And when I came here, there were like two Mexican restaurants in the whole state, and you couldn't hear Spanish being spoken in any store for months on end. But when 1994 came and NAFTA displaced so many people in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia, even before, there was a rapidly growing Latino community here. And with MIRA, half of our board are African Americans or African immigrants, and the other half of the board are Latinos, both U.S. born as well as immigrants. And we had the vision of inviting the Latinos that were coming into Mississippi as they struggled against the racism here to join with and accept the leadership of the continuing African American struggles and labor struggles here in Mississippi. The president of our organization grew up with his father, who was a bodyguard or a driver for Medgar Evers in the 40s and the 50s, Jim Evans, who was a union organizer as well. Others that have been involved, as I mentioned, Hollis and so on, have helped to really define the direction that we are going. And one of the things that was very evident to us is that even though the census in 1990 said that there were about 36% of the population African American and less than 1% Latino, we saw with the return of African Americans coming into Mississippi and with the turnaround of the decline to an increase in population, and that of the Latinos here, a real opportunity and real organizing political opportunity to connect the communities and begin to build power and invite the roughly 10% of white voters and people here in Mississippi to join with us in a long-term struggle to basically overthrow the oligarchy here in Mississippi. There's another state that is that has a demographic similar to ours, and that is South Carolina. We have, we believe, 40% African American, probably 100,000 Latinos, although the last census 10 years ago said there were 37,000. And then we have a growing Asian community that initially was Vietnamese and now is joined by South Asians from Pakistan and India and Indonesia and other places, as well as Chinese immigrants that are coming here. So we have a combination of a legal project that works on what they call papers of people to get them to get residency and other things. We have an aggressive citizenship program. But in terms of organizing, we are out in the community trying to build coalitions with various local African-American struggles. And on the Gulf Coast, we have helped form a coalition there that is called the STEPS Coalition, but also other kinds of things that are getting Latinos engaged in the continuing struggle of African-Americans and recognizing that the same issues that face African-Americans and white working class people also are the issues that affect Latinos. And so one of the things that we felt was very important was to work on the census. And there are a lot of flaws in how the census is being counted, but our goal is to try to get a complete count of African-American as well as Latino and Asian communities, because that would not only, of course, change the dynamics as far as redistricting the political districts in the state are concerned, and also could potentially increase the amount of federal money that comes in here, but it's to gain recognition of the potential political and economic power that people of color have here in Mississippi. And that is currently on one of the agendas that we have that we're working very hard. But there's a lot of other things.
See the question.
And that is, you know, employers here are exploiting workers. And there's, you know, a popular belief in some quarters that immigrants are, quote unquote, taking people's jobs. But there has been, because of the movement and the effort to properly fund public schools, which were abandoned by most whites in Mississippi after Brown versus Board of Education and the attempt to enforce the desegregation of the schools that took place, public schools did not get appropriate funding for a long, long time. And as in the 1980s, as that began to change, then more and more African-American young people were able to go to school and graduate from high school and make decisions on their own of the kind of jobs that they wanted. And they were no longer exclusively relegated to farm work or food processing or cleaning toilets or whatever. And that abandonment of those terrible jobs coincided with the stress that was created in Mexico and other countries by trade agreements and violence that was basically sponsored by the United States. So we have had people coming into those jobs. And one of the concerns that we had is that about half of the food processing plants, for example, are represented by one of four unions here in Mississippi. All of those plants were organized by black workers initially in the 60s when the plants started being set up, and then into the 70s. Some people may remember the boycotts we had in the 70s of of one of the major chicken processing plants in Laurel, Mississippi, and then other plants organized into three different union cultures within the United Food and Commercial Workers, and also into the laborers union here in Mississippi. And so one of the problems that the African American workers faced as more and more Latinos were coming into the workplaces was a perceived impossibility of communicating, because African Americans spoke English and the Latinos spoke Spanish, and nobody was bilingual. And so we were able very early on to provide organizers from our organization to help the unions make the connection. And in several places, that every single Latino worker that was approached signed up and joined the union. And in several cases made it possible for the poultry workers to make significant progress in their union contract negotiations. After Katrina, we had a tremendous amount of wage theft that took place, where local contractors primarily that were at the bottom feeders of the food chain from Halliburton and those that got most of the FEMA contracts, oftentimes the contractors would work the immigrant workers, and then when the job was done, they would abandon those workers and disappear without paying them. And we were able to locate most of where the contractors lived. We were able to get workers engaged in coming to confront their employers and make demands on wages. And because of that organizing and workers' courage to stand up to their bosses, the workers were able to recover well over $1,300,000 in the year after Katrina. The same thing occurred when we had a raid at Howard Industries in Laurel, Mississippi. That was the largest single ICE raid on immigrant workers in the history of the United States. And 595 workers were arrested. And it had a devastating impact on the Latino community in Laurel. But many of their African American co-workers came to their aid, raising money, bringing food to the families that were left behind, and also participating in some of the actions that workers who were let out with ankle bracelets, and most of them, all except one of them, were women, that they initiated with the families of the breadwinners that were locked up in ironically, Gina, Louisiana. And together they fought to be paid, because initially Howard Industries refused to pay them. And we had a fight over a period of 2 weeks of those workers led, along with the support of our legal department, and we were able to recover close to $300,000 in checks that the workers set up a committee to distribute the checks to the families that were left behind. And because of the information and the organizing that those workers did and the information they provided, there was not one misdirected paycheck to the families. And we're talking about hundreds of workers. So here in Mississippi, there's a lot going on. We have elections next year, and the primary Republican candidate for governor is the one person that kicked off the anti-Latino racism several years ago with fake reports based on the Federation of American Immigration Reform statistics that were paid for by taxpayers, you know, claiming that immigrants took a toll on public services in Mississippi, which was not true, and by his own admission, was not a statistic that was grounded in anybody's research. That he, by his own admission, he drew the figures out of midair along with FAIR. His second thing claimed to criminalize that most immigrants were criminals here in Mississippi, but he produced no statistics of any sort to support that. And as a matter of fact, the Department of Public Safety said in a very informal report that they made that just simply wasn't true. but he is the Republican candidate for governor now, and he has already engaged the campaign of xenophobia and racism by announcing that he has now, as lieutenant governor, is going to introduce a Me Too bill like the one that was passed in Arizona. And Democrats can be a problem. When we had the election several years ago, all the candidates for statewide office, save one, engaged in the same kind of race baiting that the Republicans did. And the only one who actually won the statewide elections was the single candidate that did not engage in pandering to racism. So we have a lot going on here. The redistricting as a result of the census could increase the number of elected black elected officials. May, there's a slim chance that it may make it a make a opportunity for a Latino to be elected to the state legislature. We do not have any Latinos in Mississippi elected to anything here yet. And, you know, it may, if we're successful in getting a complete count, you know, it may help us to add more African Americans and others to the legislature. And I want to say one thing in closing, and that is we have had extremely strong support for Latino issues from the Mississippi Legislative Black Caucus. And that includes defeating hundreds of xenophobic bills and introducing and passing four bills that help immigrant workers here in Mississippi. And Latinos see that because it's reported in a weekly newspaper that we have here in Spanish. It's on the radio programs and so on. So rather than being victims of white racism and pandering to Latinos to join their conservative causes, Latinos here are seeing that, you know, connecting with African Americans as the struggle progresses, you know, can mean significant benefits to the quality of life and the protection of their rights, expansion of their rights here in the state.
Thank you, Bill. Hey, we're good. We've been
Something is happening here. We are breaking up, Carl.
Did everybody got on mute? And Mitchell, are you in your car?
No, I've been in my house for a long time.
Oh, okay.
Something
to tell where the noise is coming from.
Yeah.
Stop. So let's start the discussion. Who wants to go first?
Hey, Carl, this is Renee. Thank you, all the presenters. First of all, I want to say excellent presentation. I just wanted to kind of talk about, I just returned from the Campaign for America's Future, formerly Take Back America conference. And as you probably are all aware, what was heavy was the economic issue as far as what's going on in the United States and around the world as far as the economic collapse. It was very interesting because everybody had a populist fervor as far as upset about the bailouts and, you know, wanting to do more as far as getting jobs. That was very prevalent in pretty much all the presentations around the economy and also discussions. What I thought was interesting is no one advocated or promoted the idea that capitalism is being shown as not being successful, that it's become almost an utter failure, and that no one talked about challenging the system that exists as it is, which I thought was, I mean, not one person. Erica went to several workshops, and so no one is, you know, everyone is looking at working within the system that we have, just making it better. Which I thought was pretty interesting, especially when you talk about, you know, the oil spill
advocate that regulation, regulation, but no one went back to, again, this being a for-profit system, and that's where we're seeing these massive failures, not only in healthcare, but, you know, with the banking system, the economy, I mean, not the economy, but also with the climate change issues and things like that. So I not only made a statement, but I just want to ask what the panelists thought as far as looking at the general population. Are we ready yet to have that discussion?
Yeah, this is Bill. I think one of the things that I think is opening eyes is the greed of BP. They're ignoring precautions when they were drilling in the Gulf. It's an example of, you know, really predatory capitalism that people are actually discussing, you know, even here in Mississippi, people that you wouldn't expect it to come from. So I think that that particularly, you know, has been a catalyst for, you know, expanding the discussion about the greed and exploitation associated with enterprises. And that's the third richest corporation in the world is British Petroleum.
My name is Bryce, and a thought I have on this is that we really need to sort of go out and do more of a voter registration drive that's based on, you know, that's not just minorities, but also based on sort of class, because I think right now the majority of people that vote and really get politically involved are still fairly middle class to upper class, and if you have a house with two cars in the garage, you're not likely to be a big critic of capitalism. Maybe you're a critic of what's going on right now, but you don't want to, you're not necessarily feeling like you need to see a big change. I think the people that would want a big change, unfortunately, are sort of, don't vote very often and therefore aren't heard very much. So that's kind of my thought on the question that you raised.
This is Harry. I just want to remind people that Paul Robeson, with great courage, spoke in defense of socialism and pointed out that he didn't experience racism in the former Soviet Union. And I think maybe we are ready for people like that to once again raise the issue of an alternative political and economic system.
This is Peter Deutsch. Going back to the British Petroleum situation, they didn't take precautions with their drilling, but there was something online, I don't remember, contrasting with Norway, which we consider a more socialistic country, and they apparently did take precautions, and they haven't had these blowouts, at least not so much. They've used a lot of offshore rigs for their internal supply, but I'm wondering if it might not be worth looking and seeing if their more socialistic structure also focused on more precautions in their oil efforts.
This is Milton. I was thinking at the time of the resounding defeat of Goldwater in 1964, one of the major things I think that contributed, maybe the major thing that contributed to that defeat, that there was such massive organized people in motion with a clear agenda that was completely antithetical what he put forth, and there was demonstrated evidence, certainly historical, but also at the time television, of the absolute unacceptable treatment of people struggling. This time, it seems there's not a, or not enough of in motion organized in a coherent way that gives voice this issue about system change. Now, this BP
deep disappointment and frustration, unfortunately, with, or not necessarily unfortunately, it is what it is, with inability of the champion that many people feel was, you know, promoted into the White House for being the leader of this of this voice to deal with at least BP, if not capitalism itself. And the complicated issue in that, you're kind of thankful that it's not Bush sitting there, but it's not enough for the moment for us. We're talking about, I think there needs to be a combination of both scientists, environmentalists, activists for jobs that could come together with some sort of declaration about what the future of production has to be, handing something under this administration to the kind of motion that was in the streets, led to the defeat of Goldwater, the kind of motion that was in the streets, led to at least many of the policies, if not all, but many. Don't have coherent voice who has a number of major issues together sufficiently.
I will, this is Lorenzo from Harrisburg.
Who's that?
Lorenzo from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And I would like to follow up what the lady just said, the sister just said, because basically the way I interpret what she said, which I agree 100%, is that we are lacking a party. We're lacking a political organization that will put together all the issues. There is a lot of good one-issue organizations around. I mean, here in Pennsylvania, we have a one-issue organization in terms of prepared that is very good. It has a lot of good people in it, but that's all it is. It's just a one single issue organization. We lack the organization that will put progressive emblem on all of these different issues that are affecting people. And I'm there to say that we are basically in a race against time, because the way I am a union organizer, and as a matter of fact, now I'm working as a community organizer, doing a lot of what people in the 30s did in trying to connect the labor movement with the communities. But of course, I'm not doing it in the mentality that people in the 30s did. I'm doing it in basically a different, you know, survival of the union, that type of deal. We're in a race against time because, I mean, you have to be an ostrich not to realize that the nation is falling apart. And this economic crisis is yet to be finished. Yesterday, as a matter of fact, I was talking to a friend of mine who's an organizer in Oregon, and he's telling me about the militias that are in Oregon that are getting very well trained in order to attack black and Hispanic people. And that's not surprising because that kind of militias basically are all over the country. And coming down of the economic situation, it will probably instigate this kind of we are populism, which the Tea Party would try to do, but apparently that went beyond their capabilities. And these other people, which are not, in my opinion, much more dangerous than the Tea Party, have taken over. We have the working class, we have a falling middle class, and there is no political leadership putting it all together. In, for example, I'm involved again on the single payer issue here in Pennsylvania. Inside of my group, there are people that are, that basically don't understand the connection between that issue and other issues that that are affecting working and middle class people.
Okay, anyone else?
Just a comment. This is Jim Campbell in South Carolina. I thought this was excellent and great contribution to this general discussion. My additions would be just informational, little pieces of information that may enrich our thinking and understanding of the continuity of this movement. Freedom, the magazine, the paper of Paul, was really the forerunner of Freedom Ways, and a key person that drove freedom, Louis Burnham, and Lorraine Hansberry was a part of that group. I think for those of us who know the long view of this particular movement, that may be instructive and helpful information. I don't know who the other folks were around that, but I do know that it was the forerunner for Freedom Ways, as was the student Southern Negro Youth Organization. To add to the comments on Mississippi, and I'm sorry that Bill wasn't able to get that that issue, Freedom Ways. The title of it was Opening Up the Closed Society. And it dealt with the myth that Mississippi, somewhat different from the general political culture of segregated violence of the United States, and Jack makes the point in that issue of Freedom Ways that Mississippi was central to the United States, that it was 100% a full-fledged member of the unit of the Union, and that the Zach talked about the legal obstructions, that superstructure of violence that was organized around Jim Crow laws and rules. Mississippi had the most violent and legal expression of that in the government of the United States, with people such as Bottoman, Bilbao, Rankin, Eastland, Stennis, Barnett, Paul Johnson. And it's interesting that Barber today takes a very different tack in his state's relationship to the BP crisis. He is expressing the continuance of a certain mentality in Mississippi that is representative of the embedded ideology that comes out of the Teutonic origins theory that Mildred touches on, touched upon. It would be interesting for us to look at the continuity of the Teutonic origins theory as it embedded itself in the intellectual and educational structure of the country. A curious phenomenon was that one of the professor at Harvard, who was Du Bois's advisor for his PhD dissertation, was one of the proponents at Harvard of the Teutonic origins theory. This was a theory that went through Harvard, the old institution and colleges of the country, Harvard, Stanford, Columbia, the setting up of the schools of science, of social studies, of social science and history at these colleges were based on the notion of those of the Teutonic origins theory. And the central idea of that theory was that only those people descended from the early Germanic tribes, the Teutons, were capable of organizing democratic societies. So today, when you hear about us taking on the initiative of instructing Afghanistan's and Iraqis in democracy, that's an expression of the Teutonic origins theory. And it has to do with the global nature of American empire and how that is expressed today. There is a long interview with Mrs. Hamer in that issue of Mississippi opening up the closed society and the emergence of a group of African American women around the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and their challenge in Atlantic City at the Democratic Convention in 1964. Ms. Annie Devine, Mrs. Hamer, Mrs. Anita Blackwell, and the other name doesn't come, but they were key folks who came out of that organizing, and the, and that struggle there, that emergence of the political party and political organizing, and the challenge played a key role in opening up the political establishment to the African American and poor whites in Mississippi. So it's a rich issue to look at in the history of political struggle in this country. But all in all, I think this has been a tremendously rich contribution to opening up this discussion around climbing Jacob's ladder and moving into the discussion around the democracy charter, because the charter comes out of this continuance, this continuity of experience, of insight, and the dialectic between theory and practice over many generations of movement activities in this country. Beginning with, as Mildred deposited it and raised it, beginning with the founding of the country and writing of the Constitution. The Constitution of this country may very well be the first affirmative action act for the owners of plantations in this country. If we look at that, look at it in that light, it may give us an idea of a critical examination of the continuity and what we face in terms of political forces congenital to the country. But all in all, a rich exchange and a powerful contribution to this discussion. And I do really appreciate it, and thank you for it.
Okay, the next session will be on June 19th. And the same times. And, Janet, does that mean that the telephone numbers will be the same?
Yes, the telephone numbers will be the same.
The telephone numbers will be the same. And we'll have contemporary reflections done by Mark Solop and Brandon Wallace. See everybody back here on June 19th. Glad to have you all.
Thank you for this, Carl.
Preceding recorded on 6/12/2010 off the phone. Save it and see if you can convert it to MP3. Climbing Jacob's ladder. Stop.